I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
President George Bush lands in a short while at Shannon Airport at the start of a 5-day trip that takes him to Ireland and Turkey. In contrast to the usual friendly reception for American presidents, some 20,000 protesters are expected to rally in Dublin tonight as part of a Stop Bush campaign. 6,000 Irish police and soldiers, more than a third of the country's security forces, have already been deployed. Police Inspector Ray McHugh told reporters security will be tight.
What we want to see happen is people to protest within the law. If they do that, we will certainly allow them protest. They have a democratic right to peacefully protest. But if they step outside that and engage in any other activity, we will certainly deal with it very firmly. We're very focused on our goal here.
Well, joining us from Brussels is Philip Shiskin, correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Philip, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, it's certainly been a big month for presidential diplomacy. Ireland this weekend, Istanbul on Monday. What does the president hope to get out of these meetings?
Well, you have to remember that this is the last big opportunity for President Bush before the presidential elections to demonstrate to his Democratic critics that he can really rally international support for his policies both in Iraq and elsewhere in the Middle Eastern region. So this is his really last big push before the election to garner the support, both for military reasons on the ground, but also for political legitimacy reasons abroad and domestic political reasons at home.
Well, certainly the Europeans have been less than enthusiastic about helping out in Iraq. What specifically is the president hoping to get from Europe now, and how likely is that to happen?
Well, the expectations in the past few weeks have been lowered somewhat by continued French and German resistance to committing any ground troops to the Iraqi mission under the umbrella of NATO. And I think the Bush administration has realized that it would be very difficult to get their support on the ground. So now the plan is for the Bush administration to get NATO involved in a mission to train the Iraqi security forces. It's not as significant as the ground involvement on the ground would be, but of course it's more significant than doing nothing. And so the Bush administration hopes to show that this is one way of getting more international support for Iraqi stabilization. Of course, it doesn't go as far as the White House wanted, but it goes further than perhaps many even in Europe expected a few months ago.
Well, and is he likely to get those half measures?
I think so. I think it looks very likely. There is an atmosphere of general willingness to heal transatlantic wounds that were opened last year over the war in Iraq. This Iraqi security forces training proposal doesn't really commit European critics of the war to doing anything they really don't want to do. France and Germany have already said that they would provide such training. So it gives them a nice political way to show some solidarity with the Iraqi people without really having to send troops to Iraq. So it's a halfway compromise for both sides.
Philip, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Philip Shiskin writes for The Wall Street Journal from Brussels.
With national elections in Canada 3 days away, a poll by the Globe and Mail newspaper indicates liberals and conservatives are in a dead heat. Drew Fagan is Ottawa bureau chief for the Globe and Mail. He joins us on the line from Ottawa. And Drew, the Liberal Party of Prime Minister Paul Martin had a solid lead in the first days of the campaign. That's come down to nothing. Voting is Monday. What happened?
Well, the lead actually withered very quickly. It's a 5-week campaign. Within about a week, it was down to very close to even. And they've run a very poor campaign. This party has been in power for 11 years. Paul Martin took over as prime minister only last December. He was the finance minister for many years, very successful. But he's managed to run a very weak campaign, and the Conservative Party has pummeled them over a scandal, sponsorship scandal, that involved allegations of payoffs to individuals in Quebec, really focused on that and the need for change. And they've been quite successful, although in the last few days, as Paul Martin has returned to form, the numbers have really grown even.
Well, what happens if neither of the two major parties gets a majority in Parliament?
Well, the chief electoral officer was saying this morning, incidentally, that it may take as much as a week if things are really close to decide who's the winner. The Americans know something about that. It's unlikely that will happen. You need 155 seats to have a majority. It now looks like neither of the two major parties will win more than 120 seats. So they'll have to turn to the smaller parties. And there's great irony in this, because the smaller party that's likely going to have the most seats is the Bloc Québécois. That's a Quebec separatist party that might win as many as 60 seats. So imagine that the balance of power in the Canadian Parliament is held by a separatist party from Quebec.
Well, and we had understood that the separatist movement was fading but has suddenly been reborn, I think because of the scandal that you just mentioned?
The scandal has helped them win seats. There's no question about that. The underlying issue is to what extent Quebec voters will be voting in favor of sovereignty and rebounding, as you say, really 10 years. Over the last 10 years, the sovereignty movement has been in decline. To what extent this vote expected on Monday will show signs of a bounce back by the separatist party, or to what extent they're really voting against their disgust with the Liberal government, which has traditionally been the most strongest federal party in Quebec. It's going to be very interesting to take a look at that after the vote on Monday to know that. The separatist party on the provincial level in Quebec is saying very clearly a vote for the Bloc Québécois is a vote for sovereignty. The Bloc Québécois itself is saying something very different. They're saying it's really a protest vote. We will look after Quebecers' interests in Ottawa, but it's not a vote on sovereignty. That there may come a day when there's a referendum on that, but Quebecers can feel comfortable voting for us and not signaling that they support sovereignty. It's a narrow road they're walking, but so far, fairly successfully.
And Drew, in about the minute we have left, how does all of this affect U.S.-Canada relations?
Well, it's interesting. The Bush administration thought that Paul Martin was going to be a very strong advocate. And certainly Paul Martin campaigned in favor of closer Canada-U.S. relations. There were strains, especially over the Iraq War, between the Chrétien government and the Bush administration. Paul Martin in the last month, however, has been upping the ante with what some people would say is anti-American rhetoric. And certainly claiming that Stephen Harper, the conservative leader, would walk in lockstep with the Bush administration. And, you know, Canadians, by and large, are Democrats. They lean to the left as compared to Americans, and there has been some resonance with regard to that that Martin viewpoint. I'm not sure that in the end result, no matter which campaign wins, relations will be damaged.
Well, Drew Fagan, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Drew is Ottawa Bureau Chief for Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper.
In a controversial decision reached yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that a judge cannot add to a defendant's prison sentence without the approval of a jury. The case before the court was that of Ralph Blakely of Washington State, who pleaded guilty to kidnapping his estranged wife. The judge gave him the maximum sentence of 53 months. But then when the judge heard from the victim about her ordeal, he added an extra 37 months because of the deliberate cruelty of what Blakely did. The Supreme Court's ruling means judges can't do that by themselves. And it also casts doubt on the constitutionality of sentencing guidelines set by Congress. Well, joining us on the line is Supreme Court reporter Lyle Denniston. And Lyle, tell us more about what this ruling means for judges and juries as well as defendants.
Well, this is a decision, Gail, that reaffirms very strongly the role that the jury plays in criminal trials, and particularly the role that they play in deciding what facts did occur in a particular crime. The judge can't find facts separate from the jury and impose a punishment based upon that.
But in this case, Lyle, a jury didn't even hear the case. He pleaded guilty.
Well, in pleading guilty, one admits to facts, and so the judge cannot add to the punishment based upon facts to which Blakely did not admit in his guilty plea.
Now, can you remind us why these sentencing guidelines were first put in place in 1984?
Yes, Congress and a number of academics and prosecutors and defense lawyers had complained for years and years and years that federal sentences were, in fact, quite discriminatory because they varied widely. So Congress said, let's regularize the system, and those guidelines will fairly tightly control the discretion that judges have. The whole sentencing guideline system, however, has been under severe attack now by judges and by defense lawyers because there is an argument, a continuing argument, that the new system results in a failure to consider the individual characteristics of the person, and so judges are complaining about a loss of discretion, and criminal defense lawyers are complaining about a new severity in the sentencing structure for individuals.
Well, let's explore that just a moment, because Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, in a dissenting opinion, said that what she feared most has now come to pass, with thousands of criminal judgments in jeopardy. Help us connect the dots here. Why would yesterday's ruling affect the entire system of sentencing guidelines?
Well, almost all of these systems, and certainly the federal system, allow for judges to increase the penalty above a guideline range if the judge finds additional facts. For example, in the federal system, if a person is convicted of using a gun during the commission of a crime, the judge can enhance the penalty if the judge finds that there were additional guns used. And so what we're talking about here, Gail, basically is an increase in sentences above the guideline range when the judge does so based upon his independent finding of facts of the crime, facts not found by the jury beyond a reasonable doubt.
And some judges are already holding off sentencing because they're looking for some guidance here. Where might that guidance come from?
Well, the guidance is obviously going to come from lower courts as these new challenges emerge. And as Justice O'Connor pointed out, this may put into doubt virtually every sentence that was imposed in federal or state cases since June 26, 2000, which is the date that laid down the basic constitutional premises upon which yesterday's decision was based.
Lyle, thank you.
You're welcome.
Supreme Court reporter Lyle Denniston.
And this comment, this week a Korean man was beheaded in Iraq, and I found myself wondering, is it possible we're getting used to this? The death of Kim Sun-il followed the beheading of engineer Paul Johnson in Saudi Arabia and the young Nicholas Berg in Iraq. 2 years ago, journalist Daniel Pearl was beheaded in Pakistan, but it was considered somewhat impolite to dwell on the manner of killing in his death. Now the extremists have forced our hand. The manner of killing is as much a part of the story as the death itself. The recent beheadings were seen on the Internet and watched reportedly by teenagers around the world and by a colleague who stumbled across the images and saw that this was not the efficient act she'd imagined, but a drawn-out sawing with a blunt knife while the victim screamed. The New York Times quoted a professor of Islamic studies who says, for the executioners, this is not just the beheading of an American. It is the beheading of all America. And we do seem somewhat muted. Maybe we're determined not to be manipulated by the acts of barbarians, the thinking being that if we react with stomach-clutching anguish to the beheadings, the terrorists win. I wonder, if we just get used to it, don't they win as well? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Now it can be told. The New York Times is reporting that over 20,000 pieces of gold, 2,000 years old, have been hidden away far below the Royal Palace in Afghanistan, kept secret by a handful of museum workers through the Soviet invasion, the Taliban rule, and the Afghan-American War. But last month, curators broke open the vaults holding the treasure and are now telling the story of this magnificent collection of ancient Afghan culture. Frederick Hebert is director of the project that's compiling a computerized inventory of the hidden treasures of the Kabul Museum with the help of the National Geographic Society, and he joins us on the line from Pennsylvania. Welcome, Fred.
Greetings.
Well, where was this gold first found?
This gold was found in an area of northern Afghanistan known as Ancient Bactria. It was an area of desert oases where There were lots of nomads who took advantage of the Silk Road trade that was plying between China and the West.
Mm-hmm.
So these nomads became quite rich.
And they were buried in these huge mounds, we understand, when they died, these burial grounds that were just sort of like mud and clay mounds?
Well, the burials were actually made in older mounds, Bronze Age mounds that are about 4,000 years old. And probably they hid them in amongst the walls of these ancient remains so that nobody would find the burials.
And when were they unearthed from the mounds?
The excavators found them in 1978 and began the real excavations of the burials in 1979, just before the Soviet invasion happened. They found one burial, two burials. All of a sudden, they had six burials with so much gold on them that they couldn't leave.
Can you describe some of the pieces?
Well, it's a marvelous collection of Silk Road art that has a mixture of Greek and Roman, Chinese, Siberian motifs, a melting pot of civilizations creating a unique culture there in northern Afghanistan.
Carlotta Gall writes in the New York Times about clasps decorated with Cupids riding dolphins, pendants depicting a king wrestling with a dragon, warriors struggling with lions. And this was all seen in the 70s and then suddenly locked away. Tell us now, how did they come to be locked up and hidden? What happened?
Well, the excavator found these burials just on the eve of the Soviet invasion into Afghanistan. And in fact, there was a lot of question, were the objects spirited away? Were they melted down? They immediately had to be hidden away.
We understand that just a handful of bank workers decided to put these pieces in vaults, as we said, in the palace, three floors down, and kept it a secret?
Well, this is a traditional system for museum curation in Afghanistan and other parts of Central Asia, where a key holder is responsible for the preservation of their collections. And in Afghanistan, they took this job very seriously.
We understand that the vaults had to be broken over because that key holder, in fact, in the mid-90s when the Taliban seized control, he was so afraid that it would be found that he snapped the key off in the lock. And so that the Taliban could not enter the vault because it was impenetrable.
It was an impenetrable situation, and yet everybody was trying to get at the gold. We're just thankful that the heroism mm-hmm. of the museum people mm-hmm. and the bank people in Afghanistan preserved this treasure. They would basically say, oh, there's nothing here.
Only 20,000 pieces of gold jewelry.
When we went in and opened this vault, we knew that several of the people in the room with us were responsible for saving these materials, and yet they stood there stoically, and I think I could see a glimmer in their eye that they were really happy that we could verify that this material was intact.
What will happen next? Will it be shown? I know it's packed away now and locked away.
It's packed back up, and the next step is up to the government of Afghanistan. We're honored to say that they liked our inventory so much that they're opening up other boxes for us to look at, and we'll see what else is saved from the treasures of Afghanistan.
What's it like to hold these pieces?
These are objects that we thought were lost, and in many ways we grieved the fact that they were lost. And we thought nobody's ever seen them, nobody's ever had a chance to study them. So when the boxes opened and they actually were there, it was an emotional situation. We really couldn't believe that these were the objects, but they came object after object after object. And it seemed that it was almost planned that we went from the more general objects to the more elaborate and exquisite objects, so that at the end of the inventory, we were looking at objects that clearly had the influence of the great civilizations of the world, China, of Greece, of Siberia, of India, all rolled up into these objects that were clearly made in northern Afghanistan, clearly a symbol of the ancient Silk Road and its richness as a center of civilization.
I'm picturing this mound, and I'm just thinking of, you know, Aladdin and Alibaba and the three wise men. I mean, it just resonates with history. Also, your thoughts about these people who guarded this for so long could have stolen it themselves. We'll get nothing out of it. I'm assuming they're not getting a pendant or anything.
No, they're not getting a pendant.
What? I mean, you know, just as you said, the quiet power of what they did.
Well, it's a certain aspect of the noble character of Afghanistan that here you have a cultural feature, this keyholder post, which transcended governments. It went from the old Afghanistan government to the communist government to the Taliban government to today, and still that system of keyholder remained. And we have to honor this tradition. Yeah,
these are noble people.
These are noble people, and it's important for Afghanistan's future in building their national character and for the world to understand that here's a country whose past is as rich as the ancient cultures of Egypt, Mesopotamia, or China.
Fred Hebert is the Archaeology Fellow for the National Geographic Society, which, along with the National Endowment for the Humanities, funded the recent inventory project of the Kabul Museum. Fred, thanks so much for telling us about it.
Thank you very much.
Next week on Here and Now, Boston is the first city in the country to start randomly checking passengers on its public transportation system.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
The words, "I'm sorry," don't always come easily in the nation's capital. Just ask Vice President Dick Cheney. He and Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy were on the Senate floor for a group photograph on Tuesday when idle chit-chat quickly turned partisan and ugly. The vice president used the F-word to Leahy and stalked off. So far, nobody's saying they're sorry. But Assistant Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz is apologizing for something entirely different. In a formal letter, Wolfowitz offered a, quote, heartfelt apology for telling Congress on Tuesday that journalists in Iraq who are too scared to go out and get the real story are printing rumors instead of facts. Well, we've asked two media watchers to help us figure out all of this. Tim Rutten writes for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. And Mark Jerkowitz for the Boston Globe. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Gil.
Well, let's start with this Cheney-Leahy exchange. Ironically, it happened on the same day that the defense voted on the Defense of Decency Act, 99-1, no less. And also this week, Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle proposed family retreats to help Republicans and Democrats get to know each other a little bit better. Your thoughts, Tim?
Well, I think that, you know, it's been a bad few weeks for the administration, so they're probably getting a little short-tempered there. And Mr. Cheney is not exactly a tolerant individual. I mean, partly that's part coming from Wyoming. You in New England there, you know, are taciturn. You just think it.
Or sometimes
Wyoming people tend to speak their minds.
And Mark, what do you think? Are we making too much of this?
Well, I don't think this is going to be a story with legs. For one thing, given all the mystery that surrounded Dick Cheney, his whereabouts, his control or lack thereof over the levers of power of the administration, I think an incident like this might actually serve to humanize them in some strange way. But the other thing is there is a legitimate cultural issue here. You know, 10 years ago, if this happened, I think people would be shocked, and I think there'd be water cooler talk, and I think the story would stick around. But let's face it, this is a country that tunes in every Sunday night to listen to Tony Soprano and his pals throw 50 F-bombs in a 1 minute scene. So I think we've been a little inoculated to this kind of language, and it's just not as shocking, despite the lack of decorum. It's simply not as shocking to our sensibilities as it would have been a decade ago.
Well, let me ask you.
I think Mark's absolutely right. By the way, we may not be a more candid society, but we're certainly a coarser one than we were 10 or 15 years ago.
Well, and what do you make of the fact that the Washington Post actually printed the exact quote? Now, that was a little surprising, wasn't it?
That was a very interesting issue. And I was a little surprised that a major mainstream paper, used the actual term. On the other hand, that's legitimate clarification of the issue.
Hmm.
I think context is everything. And I think it was a brave decision on the part of the Post to do this. It's not something we would do at the LA Times.
And so what did you do? F...
We don't do that either. I mean, we like the New York Times did this morning. I think we sort of twist ourselves into pretzel-like circumlocutions.
Hmm.
It ends up being like my 10-year-old son coming back and saying that he'd seen a movie with inappropriate language, and one of them was the F word that rhymed with truck. And,
somehow I think everybody knows what we're talking about.
Yeah, I somehow think it's, this is, at some point, this is absurd given given the way, we speak in public. But it also, I think, is a measure of, when it's a vice president of the United States, I think you have an obligation to demonstrate both the depth of his anger and the lack of self-control.
Well, and also we should point out that technically profanity is not permitted in the Senate chamber, but in this case they weren't actually in session, so I guess no harm, no foul.
Right. Well, senators used to duel regularly, so it's probably a step up from that.
Mm-hmm. That's the second close skirmish that the vice president has had on a legal issue, as we know in the Supreme Court about him having to turn over records of the energy meeting. So he's lucked out twice on a legal front in recent days.
Big week for him. Well, let me ask you about the Wolfowitz apology. His comment earlier was that journalists were printing rumors in Iraq instead of fact because they were afraid to go out and get the real story. Do you think that apology is sincere, or was he reacting to criticism from journalists, 34 of whom, by the way, have been killed while covering the war in Iraq?
Well, I think that you're always obliged to accept someone's apology as sincere, and unless you have evidence to the contrary. So I think that it was deeply offensive. I'm glad that Mr. Wolfowitz retracted them as quickly as he did.
Yeah, Gil, I agree with Tim. I mean, I think one of the signs of adulthood is when you start to actually decide that it's good enough when people actually do the right things and you don't bother to figure out whether they're doing it for the right reasons or not. This was Wolfowitz's tortured way of saying there's some good news in Iraq that's not being reported. Now, you can make that argument if you want to. I don't think that that's a compelling argument. But to say that it's not being reported because reporters are too chicken to try and get the story was just one more absurdity that you can chalk up to him.
Let's move on to Bill Clinton, who certainly dominated the week in political news coverage. The New Yorker magazine had a cartoon of Clinton elbowing his way in front of John Kerry at a campaign event. And, Mark, you've written about Bill Clinton and his book, and you describe him as a compelling, if not always convincing, TV performer, as he's been making the rounds this week. Why so?
Bill Clinton was his own variety show on television this week. I mean, you saw more faces of this guy, and I don't necessarily mean this in a pejorative sense. I mean, he was everything from legitimately contrite to at various points being defiant. And sometimes there was the old Bill Clinton spin, such as, when he told Dan Rather that he still really didn't inhale. He's incapable of inhaling. What's fascinating to me about this is the thrust of every one of these interviews was, let's not talk about the Balkans. Let's not talk about the economy. Let's talk about what made you tick. And I think that makes him a very, very unique character in the annals of American politics. And, he told us a little bit about the personal failings that led him into the disastrous liaison with Monica Lewinsky without, excavating and truly examining his failings. I thought it was an interesting tightrope walk.
And, Tim, what did you make of the Bill Clinton show on TV this week?
I think that Mark's on to something very important, and that is that there are two things about the Clintons because you always speak of them in the plural, even when the other isn't there. First of all, they're outsized personalities in an era when our public personalities, despite the gravity of the issues, seem rather small. And I think also there's a kind of nostalgia, because after all, what was America like during that interregnum between the end of the Cold War and the beginning of the War on Terror when Bill Clinton was president? It was peaceful. It was prosperous in a way it never had been before. And the big story of the Clinton administration was the soap opera. And as Mark says, Clinton is an extraordinarily engaging, whatever his failings may or may not have been as president, he's one of the great, great candidates of all time, and certainly in my lifetime. And, that's what he's on the campaign trail right now, and it's where he excels, his natural milieu.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gail.
Mark Jerkowitz is media critic for the Boston Globe. Tim Rutten is media critic for the Los Angeles Times.
Still to come, how is Middle America receiving Michael Moore's new movie?
You're listening to Here and Now.
Hello. You've reached the apology number. Feel free to apologize for anything. Say you're sorry. The idea is to make yourself feel better.
The calls come in from payphones in New York City, offices in Wisconsin. Some sound like callers might have just slipped out of a family gathering to leave a message.
I think I'm mostly sorry for stealing all those oranges out of the crate the other day. When I went to the farmer's market, I just couldn't help myself.
I'm sorry that I didn't try harder in school the past 3 years.
And I was calling to let you know that I'm sorry that I turned my back on true love.
The Apology Hotline is a project begun by a Vassar University student, giving callers an opportunity to get an unsaid apology anonymously off their chest that they didn't want to or perhaps couldn't say in person. And joining us on the line is Jesse Jacobs, an art history major from Florida, whose idea this was. Welcome, Jesse.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. How'd you get the idea to do this?
Accountability has always been something that was really a big deal within my family, and we got into this conversation about how it's becoming harder and harder to be accountable within society because of all the pressures that are put on you and all the trouble you'll get in for admitting that you've made a mistake. And so I decided that it would be interesting to have a venue, an avenue, where people who can't be accountable in person for whatever reason, because of fear or guilt or because loved ones have passed away, could call up and anonymously apologize.
How do people find out about it?
Well, I've done some advertising in Time Out and the New York Press, and I also have apologize cards with the telephone number to the line that I carry around with me wherever I go, and I'll be riding the subway and I'll leave 5 cards on the seat, or I'll go to a convenience store and I'll leave 5 cards on the counter, or a coffee shop and leave 5 cards and just hope that it intrigues somebody and they pick the cards up and call the line before they throw them out.
Well, clearly it's been intriguing a lot of people. What sorts of things do you hear?
Mostly calls about interpersonal relationships, I would say.
Are you concerned that someone might use this line as a substitute for getting help that they might need?
I guess the truth is I can't really be too concerned about that. I can't get involved with the people who called because there's so many people who are calling. There certainly are times when I feel like I want to call and console people, but then I don't. It's not my place at all.
Well, maybe you've done your part by just giving them the outlet.
That's exactly what I'm hoping. I hope that, and I feel like this is true because at the end of a lot of the apologizes, people will thank me. Thank you for setting up this avenue. I feel better. And that makes me feel great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jesse Jacobs is a student at Vassar University. He joined us on the line from his home in Florida.
Did you never call? waited for your calls, rivers of suggestion were driving me away. The trees were bend, the cities wash away.
Stay with us. There's more ahead.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Move over, Harry Potter. Make room for Michael Moore. Advance ticket sales for the new Michael Moore movie, Fahrenheit 9/11, are brisk. Theater owners everywhere are bracing for an onslaught of audiences, anticipating today's nationwide opening of a documentary.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
President Bush speaking at a fundraiser in a scene from Michael Moore's new documentary, Fahrenheit 9/11. It's been talked about and talked about. Now you can finally see it. Should you? Ted Barron, film programmer at the Harvard Film Archive, is here in the studio with his review of this very controversial film. Hello, Ted.
Hi, Robin.
You know, I say, should someone see it? Well, they're going to make up their own mind, of course. But I guess the question is, you know, what really is it? Is it what it says it is, an anti-Bush piece, or is there something more here? Is there art here?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting because the film is very much what it purports to be. I mean, it's an unabashed attack on the Bush administration. And where I think we get into this question of whether it's art or whether it's something else is this whole idea of propaganda. And this film actually in some ways fits into an interesting kind of history of propaganda. It goes back to, you know, the silent film era where you had the Soviets making propagandistic statements, or in Germany, a film like Triumph of the Will. Mm. Michael Moore's film is a film which doesn't really have the same kind of cinematic achievement that those earlier works do. Yet I think the ideology of the film is something that's much more acceptable to people than some of those earlier works.
But the other thing that this film would seem to have that some other what we think of as typical propaganda films or documentaries with ideology, what they don't have is Michael Moore.
Of course. There's been a lot talked about in terms of his presence in the film and how in some ways this represents a move back for him and that you don't see him as much in the film. The tone of the film is slightly more somber than some of the earlier works, which have a definite jokiness to them. This film certainly has very strong elements of humor. I mean, there's actually a really funny instance where he's outside of the Saudi embassy, where he starts to make connections between the Bush family and the Saudis, and he has an encounter with a Secret Service agent that's very much a typical Michael Moore moment.
In fact, we have that. Let's listen.
Steve Kimball, Secret Service. How are you doing, sir?
Yes.
We're just ascertaining information regarding, are you doing a documentary regarding the Saudi Arabia embassy?
Yes. Even though we were nowhere near the White House, for some reason, the Secret Service had shown up to ask us what we were doing standing across the street from the Saudi embassy.
I didn't realize the Secret Service guards foreign embassies.
Not usually, no, sir.
No, no. Did they give you any trouble, Saudis?
No comment on that, sir.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll take that as a yes.
Funny in that way that he can be, but was he also in that scene trying to further his point that there's a tie between the Bush administration and the Saudis because, look, here's the Secret Service at the embassy?
Yes. I mean, this is part of a dizzying series of events that are presented within the film that follow not only George W. Bush but his father in their history with the Saudis in terms of, you know, trying to establish their relationships.
And it sounds also as if others have said it. I mean, there have been books written about this.
That's what I think one of the disappointing things about the film is that it offers a sort of greatest hits package of a lot of the arguments that have been put forth by people like Richard Clark, Paul O'Neill, and even Bob Woodward, who's, you know, slightly more sympathetic in his treatment of the president. But it also, in terms of other films that have come out recently, films like Control Room, which is actually doing quite well in terms of its the way that it examined the Al Jazeera network, but also smaller films like Unprecedented, which was a film that analyzed the 2000 election, and Horns and Halos, which was about the limitation of the book Fortunate Son, which was very critical of Bush. A lot of these films and texts have already started to make these arguments about him. So Moore doesn't really give us anything new in terms of the core argument that he makes in the first half of the film.
Right. But he does, again, it comes back to he gives us himself and his take on things. Is there a place that you can cite where that maybe even gets in the way of making the point he wants to make?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the moments in the film which has gotten a lot of acclaim is the very well-known footage of Bush learning that the World Trade Center had been attacked. And it's a clip of him sitting in front of a classroom, and we see him sit there for what seems like such an extended period of time that we wonder why he isn't jumping to act. Now, that footage on its own speaks volumes, but Moore decides to use that footage and then go back and offer his own articulation about what he thinks Bush is thinking at that moment, which is, did my Saudi friends betray me in some way? Which is, you know, sort of overstating the argument that he's already kind of put forth and not letting the elements that he have just sort of speak for themselves.
But then it also sounds as if people who like Michael Moore are going to love seeing some of the kinds of things he does, that he still does the stunts, the ice cream truck.
Yeah, the ice cream truck stunt is actually pretty amusing. It's when Moore learns about the Patriot Act, he finds out most of the congressmen haven't even read the Patriot Act and that it was basically just pushed through. So he gives his own unique response to that.
I couldn't believe that virtually no member of Congress had read the Patriot Act before voting on it. So I decided the only patriotic thing to do was for me to read it to them.
Members of Congress, this is Michael Moore. I would like to read to you the USA Patriot Act, Section 1.
So there Michael Moore hijacks an ice cream truck
in front of the congressional building.
Was there a lot of that, though, that trademark in the film?
Much less. The second half of the film takes a much more somber tone because it starts to reflect on the events in Iraq and sort of the aftermath of that, which Moore frames in a context of how it's affected middle America.
Well, I guess the big question is, Michael Moore has said that he wants this film to influence the presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
Will it?
It's a hard question to answer. I mean, you know, in terms of a documentary, this is one of the biggest releases that a documentary has ever seen. I think it's going out on something like 868 screens was the number I saw recently, which is bigger than any other documentary. But compared to a major Hollywood film, that's relatively small. I'm curious where those screens actually are. Is it basically being targeted in places that will be seen as more sympathetic?
What'd you think of the movie overall?
I'm pretty dissatisfied with the film overall. I mean, I think it kind of makes it too easy to dislike Bush. The critique of the Bush administration is the fact that they've tried to control the message so strongly about what the administration is up to, why we go into these certain events, and the fact that they use snippets of evidence to make a larger argument about something. And that's largely what he's doing throughout most of the film.
Well, Ted, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
For helping us review Michael Moore's new film, Fahrenheit 9/11, which opens wide across the country today. Ted Barron is film programmer at the Harvard Film Archive.
At one theater in the crucial swing state of Ohio, multiple weekend screenings of Fahrenheit 9/11 have already sold out. At 12:01 this morning, the lights dimmed over the first crowd to see the film at the Drexel Theater in Bexley, Ohio. And joining us on the line to tell us how that went is Anna Bizaha, general manager of the theater. Anna, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Now, clearly, if people came to the movies at midnight, they must have really wanted to see it. Was this a sellout?
Yes. We actually sold out our main house, and then at a last-minute decision, we interlocked the film so that it could show simultaneously on another screen, and we sold out that house as well. So we had a total of just over 400 people.
And are most of these advance ticket sales, or people just show up and you're able to let them in?
Well, we sold out the main house earlier in the day, and we started selling for the second house at about 10:30, so the second house sold out pretty much just in walk-ins.
And what's been the response to the film?
So far, so good. Everybody last night was very positive. We didn't have really any protesters or people yelling at us or anything, which we'd have been expecting. And everybody, they were cheering. We could hear them from the lobby cheering and clapping and everything at certain parts throughout the film.
Why were you expecting protesters?
Well, we'd been getting a lot of calls for the last couple of weeks, both positive and negative. There's actually a website out that lists every theater that it's showing at and their phone numbers specifically for people to call and protest. So we were just expecting them to continue, but they sort of laid off in the last couple of days.
And how would you compare the interest in this film to some of the other films that you've had? Is there anything else that you can think of that has been this popular this quickly at the opening?
The last really controversial film that we showed that I know of was The Last Temptation of Christ, that we had similar response where people were calling and protesting and everything like this.
And that was some years ago, right?
Yeah, that was actually before I started working here.
Mm.
But that's the thing that people have been most comparing it to.
Sounds as if you're in for a busy weekend.
Yes, it should be interesting.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Anna Bazaha is the general manager of the Drexel Theater in Bexley, Ohio.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Have a great weekend.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.